You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm Ankit Panda, your host here at the podcast, and I'm joined today by Mina Pullman, a former editorial assistant with us here at the Diplomat and now a contributor for our Tokyo Report blog. Mina covers Japan in great detail for us, everything from domestic politics to security, and I'm really glad to have her on the show today. Thanks for joining me, Mina. How are you doing today?
Good. I'm excited to be doing this.
Yeah, it's been a while that you've been writing for the Diplomat. How long has it been now for you?
About a year and a half now, I would say. Yeah, a year and a half.
Great. Well, I've been following your writing with great interest, so it's finally a pleasure to have you on the podcast. And Japan in particular, I've always been very much interested in for personal reasons, and just, it's one of the more important countries in the region that we cover here at the Diplomat. And particularly in recent years, Japan's been going through some interesting times since Shinzo Abe and the Liberal Democratic Party came back to power in December 2012. So, Mina, we have a lot to talk about here, but I do want to, peg this podcast discussion to the upcoming upper house elections in Japan. And the upper house, the House of Councilors in Japan, is the upper house in the bicameral parliament, which is known as the Diet. And the way I understand it, Mina, there's 121 seats that'll be up for grabs out of a total of 242. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So it's about a six-year term, and then half of them go up every 3 years. It's in the summer, unlike the lower house, which can vary depending on the prime minister's convenience.
Right. So, Mina, why don't you tell us a bit about, the broader dynamics of Japanese politics right now within the legislature? The way I see it, and I'm not as close an observer of Japanese domestic politics as you are, but I do follow it somewhat. It seems like Shinzo Abe and the LDP are still pretty well positioned, and there's no real threat to Abe's personal leadership or the broader position of the LDP. But can you tell us a bit about the stakes in this upcoming upper house election and really why our listeners should be interested or care about this?
So I think you're right. I think a lot of people do expect Shinzo Abe and the ruling Liberal Democratic Party Kumeito coalition to do really well this election. It'll probably be their fourth consecutive victory since Abe came back to power back in December 2012. And this election is being framed as a referendum on Abenomics. That's the rhetoric that's surrounding it. And it's a lot of the ruling party wants to make it about how they are the party that can revive and make Japan's economy
great again.
Yeah, great again, to put it one way. And then the opposition is also just as happy to make it about the economy because they think they have some pretty good arguments for why Abenomics is failing. So one way to view this election is as a referendum on Abenomics. But in general, a lot of people do expect LDP Kumeito to do really well. That's one reason why Abe has made it publicly his goal to win over half of the seats that are contested, sort of trying to set a criteria by which he can claim a mandate afterwards, since it's pretty clear that they're going to do better than the opposition.
Right. And just for our listener, Abenomics is the set of economic policies that Shinzo Abe's government, along with Haruhiko Kuroda, who is the Bank of Japan governor, has been trying really hard to implement with limited degrees of success. Japan saw some initial results, but lately, the country has seen two recessions, currently in one. There's a fiscal arm, a monetary arm, and a structural arm to these reforms, and they're incredibly comprehensive, looking to bring Japan out of over two decades of stagnation and a lack of growth. Right. But Mina, I wanted to, also dig in a bit on the opposition, since from what I understand, there have been some interesting developments with the Japanese opposition lately, namely the emergence of a merged party called the Democratic Party, which includes the former Democratic Party of Japan and the Japan Innovation Party. So tell me a bit about Katsuya Okada and the Democratic Party of Japan. Do they have an alternate vision for Japan that's significantly different from what Abe and the LDP are proposing, specifically on the economic front?
So where the Democratic Party comes from, it's essentially a merger of the Democratic Party of Japan. The Democratic Party of Japan ruled, or they were the ruling party from 2009 to 2012. And in general, it led to sort of a disillusionment by the Japanese public with the DPJ, as they're known. A big part of it was their lack of experience, and they didn't really know how to work with the Japanese bureaucracy when they came in, and they were already having a lot of issues. And it was really unfortunate timing, in a sense, because then the Great Japan Earthquake happened, and even if the LDP had been in power, they probably would have struggled with the response. But, the DPJ had the, I suppose, bad luck of being in power at the time. And voters are still very hesitant, I think, to give the kind of responsibility back to the DPJ. So the DPJ, that's the party that merged with the Japan Innovation Party, and essentially they were trying to rebrand themselves, but this happened in March, like not that long ago, end of March. And so a lot of voters, I think, do view this new party with some sort of suspicion, because it doesn't really seem to be exactly a party based on principle, but a party based on opportunism, because they really did form in preparation of the upper house election, which politically, I mean, it's obviously not a bad tactic at all. But if you're looking for like a principled alternative vision, then voters don't really know if that's what they're going to be getting with the DP. In addition, the DP, again, they've made a big claim that they can be better stewards of the Japanese economy in the sense that they've been attacking Abenomics. So for example, like with Abenomics, Abe can say that like wages have been growing, I think 2% for 3 or so years consecutively. He can also claim that corporate bankruptcies have been declining, and that there are actually more people who are working and more job openings. But the DP, on the other hand, can claim that a lot of the jobs that are increasing are irregular workers.
Right.
So it's not exactly, and also like real wages still have been stagnating. And again, like we're back in recession after the consumption tax was increased last time. So there's economically also, DP is more focused on like social welfare, I would say, except a lot of their policies that they have advocated, they're trying to increase support for childcare, right. Increasing spots of childcare. And they're also interested in these sorts of grant scholarships where they wouldn't have to pay them back afterwards. But the LDP has actually recently adopted a lot of these policies, which the DP accuses the LDP of like policy poaching, in the sense that by adopting a lot of the policies that the DP used to use to distinguish itself, the LDP can make their a little bit, you know, what's the point of electing the DP if the LDP is promising the same thing and you know the LDP can more likely get it done.
Right, exactly. That's actually what you said there at the end is kind of what I perceive as a big problem for the Japanese opposition. Yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of things you did bring up are pretty significant differences from the LDP. I mean, there's also the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has been a hot issue in Japanese public opinion. And that's certainly something that Abe is very, very keen about. And I know that several people in his government are very anxious at the prospect of a Donald Trump presidency, right. Particularly, you know, not just for the TPP, but just for the broader state of the U.S. Japan alliance. Mina, let's talk a bit about the puzzle that I sort of see in Japanese politics right now. And you can maybe, you know, shed some light on this, why this is the case. So Abe and the LDP, as we've both identified, are pretty well positioned. They're set for another big win, basically. There's no real threats to the prime minister's position right now. Abe has stopped the old revolving door of prime ministers that kept going on after Koizumi's tenure. Now, Japanese public opinion and Japanese voters, however, sort of tell you a different picture, I think, if you kind of look at the polls and what they're saying. I mean, not just the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but issues like nuclear power, issues like, you know, just broader economic policies. Obviously, the failure of Abenomics is another thing. But essentially, you know, Japanese public opinion hasn't really been down with a lot of the things that Abe's been trying to do. Also, I should bring up the Article 9 reinterpretation on collective self-defense, which also stirred some major protest. So what's going on here? Are Japanese voters simply, disillusioned? You know, they know that they're not getting what they want with the LDP in some ways, but really, what you said about the DP is very true. I mean, they don't know that they can actually get results with the DP. So is that what's driving, you know, the LDP's continued success? This just sort of very cynical disillusionment? Or is there something else going on?
So the way I think of it is, I sort of organize my thoughts as a set of like more proximate causes than ultimate causes. Proximate causes would be things that are going on like right now, like this particular upcoming election cycle. And so what I already mentioned before, the suspicion towards the DP because it's a new party, it's formed for very tactical reasons. And another very particular reason, cause for this election, I would say, is a coordination with the Japanese Communist Party, which a lot of you voters would still view as somewhat suspiciously. I haven't been able to bring it up yet, but like I guess obviously delaying the consumption tax is actually a really big deal. And if you look at, for example, like the manifestos, I think the JCP, one issue they have is that they don't think they should raise a consumption tax, period. The DP, DP does agree that the consumption tax needs to be raised but should be delayed. So that's one sort of like an important policy difference between the two parties that they've kind of chosen to like paper over in a sense in order to coordinate. Tactically, again, this makes sense because in previous elections, like the last SNAP election that was held December 2014, part of the reason the SNAP election work to Abe's favor was he didn't give the opposition time to coordinate their candidates, which in this case, DP and JCP have been able to do. So in districts where they're electing like constituent races, where you're directly voting for your candidate instead of the proportional risk list part of the races, DP and JCP are coordinating, which allows, in a weird way, Abe to paint the election sort of almost like as like, do you really want to go with the JCP? I mean, the JCP has historically advocated for dissolving the self-defense forces, and also they're opposed to the U.S.-Japan Mutual Security Treaty. So they're kind of, it's a gamble that Okada, the leader of the DP, has taken to that like independents won't mind that he's allying with the JCP, but that might actually work to his favor. So that's like one of the proximate causes for why the opposition might not do so well.
Yeah, but longer term, you know, there's also been a depression in election turnout. From what I understand, Japanese people are just less interested in voting these days. Is that true?
Yeah, I think the past 2012, 2013, the election turnout was around in the high 50s range or something, and then the last two have been in the low 50s range, like 52% or something like that. So a lot of people are just choosing to turn away from politics because there isn't a valid protest vote, is I think the way I would put it.
Right.
Because in the last lower house election, JCP actually went from 8 to 21 seats. So JCP was sort of seen as a protest vote, but they don't really, you know, again, most mainstream Japanese people still wouldn't consider JCP as a good option. So if you, and then they don't think the, well, back then it would have been the DPJ, but they didn't think the DPJ was different enough or competent enough that it was worth it to, you know, go all the way to the voting booth and like cast a vote.
Right. And the competency issue is actually very interesting. We just had a recent piece of The Diplomat looking at the Abe government's very deep understanding and very keen grip over Japan's bureaucracy, which is, you know, a big part of Japanese politics. The bureaucracy is incredibly powerful. If a government knows how to work with the bureaucracy, if the Kante or the cabinet knows how to work with the bureaucracy, governments are just going to get a lot more done in Japan. And it seems like the DPJ and now the DP, I guess voters can't really trust on them to do that.
I think that's what, like, you know, I think that's what the Japanese people took away when the DPJ was in power. It is interesting, though, because Abe has managed to much more enforce his will on the bureaucracy. I don't know if that's the best way to put it. But there used to be, I think, a lot more negotiation with the bureaucracy, but Abe has been able to get his way, which I think is interesting. And also kind of related to the competency issue, there was a really interesting piece I read recently by Ethan Schneider. This is a very much a structural cause of why the opposition doesn't do as well. But what he looks at is the LDP as a party is unpopular, but they feel better candidates. And Schneider defines better or quality candidates in the sense that they're like former local level politicians. And when you think of it that way, it makes sense that it's the LDP that does well on the national level because it's the LDP that dominates at the local level. And the reason the LDP dominates even at the local level is because Japan, the way their financial system is, like financial distribution system is set up, it's very centralized. Japan is a unitary state, so a lot of the prefectures do need to get funding from the central government. And if you're, you know, you need to cooperate with the central government to get money for your prefecture, which means it's a lot easier if you are a member of the same party as a ruling party, right? So like, right. It makes sense that at the local level, LDP politicians will be seen better by the voters because they're, you know, quote unquote, succeeding in bringing home the money from the central government. So LDP is better at fostering talent, and they're better at fostering talent at the local level because they already dominate at the central government level. So it's sort of like this cycle where it's really hard for the opposition to do well because they don't have as many opportunities to foster that kind of local level talent.
Right. Yeah, this is a very interesting topic. I wish we could, you know, dig in deeper and go into like the political science literature on what makes, you know, political parties succeed in certain political contexts, like in Japan. But you're right. It seems like the LDP really has this thing down institutionally. And I guess that points to, you know, their long history as Japan's dominant political party, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I do want to go back also to the consumption tax issue. I don't want to get too much into the economics of Japan, which is something I could probably talk on for hours, but I'm sure it would make for a very dry podcast. But, you know, the consumption tax hike was delayed. For listeners, the consumption tax hike matters because Japan has one of the highest public debts in the world, and essentially the government needs to be able to pay down some of that debt, so it needs higher revenues, which means sometimes you have to raise taxes. The problem is tax increases are highly unpopular, so due to political considerations, they often get delayed in Japan is what happens. So, Mina, realistically, when do you think this the next consumption tax hike might happen, and why?
So it's predicted, or so Abe did say on June 1st when he made his announcement that the next tax hike would take place October 2019, which, according to party rules, Abe does have to step down as leader of the party September 2018. So it's interesting that he's kind of like managed to push it off past the end of his term. It'll become, the next LDP leader or prime minister if it's not the LDP in power. It'll be their become their problem.
All right, Mina. So given that this is a podcast on Asian geopolitics, I feel like we owe it to our listeners to talk a bit about international issues surrounding Japan. Some of these have already come up. We've talked about the U.S.-Japan alliance in the context of domestic politics, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We're also doing this podcast at an interesting time because the East China Sea seems to have heated up recently. So let's talk a bit about, Japanese foreign affairs right now. What do you think? Let's start with the TPP. What do you think the prospects are for the Trans-Pacific Partnership's ratification in Japan?
It will happen. I think the DP is opposed to the TPP, even though it was originally the DPJ was in power when Japan began these discussions about the TPP. So their opposition is really much more opportunistic.
Sort of like Hillary Clinton, I guess, right?
Yeah. So essentially, there are some farmers who are still very frustrated with Abe and his decision to go ahead and, join the TPP, and I do think it will be ratified. Whether this is enough to turn the tide in favor of DP, probably not. And farmers will eventually have to get along with Abe's agenda, I think.
Right. And what about the U.S.-Japan alliance? We recently saw the defense guidelines renewed last April. Abe came to the United States. He spoke out very strongly in favor of the alliance and in favor of what he's long described as turning Japan into a proactive contributor to peace in the Asia-Pacific, which some countries, namely China, see as a thinly veiled attempt at covering up resurgent Japanese militarism. But we could talk about that on a separate podcast, perhaps. But, there's obviously tensions in Okinawa. Most prominently, those tensions are still going on regarding the status of the U.S. base. But how do you see the U.S.-Japan alliance playing a role in Japanese domestic politics these days?
I think so. There have been a series of really unfortunate incidents in Okinawa, and I think it will definitely impact LDP and Komeito showing there. I don't think the LDP candidate, she's not going to, do well there. But it probably won't have a much of a spillover effect outside of Okinawa. In terms of the rest of the U.S.-Japan alliance, I mean, people generally, again, I think, yeah, in general, the support is going to remain strong. After the elections, Abe might be able to do more in the sense that maybe more planning with the U.S., some things that he might have been hesitant to do until the elections are over that would kind of make it more concrete, the implications of this new guidelines.
And let me
Yeah.
also ask you a bit. So about the East China Sea, how do, Chinese provocations near the Senkakus, the recent entry into territorial waters near Kyushu, how do these things play into Japanese public opinion about the role of the maritime self-defense forces? Does that really have an effect? If the Japanese people see China being more provocative, does that make them more sympathetic to Abe's interest in turning Japan into a more proactive country in the region?
I imagine it would, since the one thing that unites all the opposition parties really is scrapping the security legislation that Abe just passed last year. I think it's actually, they're not doing themselves any favor, especially in light of China's recent activities. With China sending their ships into both territorial and contiguous waters of what Japan considers its territory. Sorry, definitely territorial and contiguous waters, and then Senkaku is disputed. But it's, I think it only highlights the importance of cooperation with other states, including the US. So China is, in a way, helping the LDP, ironically, because it makes the DP and JCP's opposition to the security legislation look a little bit untenable.
Right, that's what I would have thought. I think I agree with that assessment, definitely. So, Mina, you've given us a pretty broad overview here of a range of issues that are both relevant not only to the upcoming upper house elections, but will be relevant for a while in Japanese politics. Is there anything that you think we left out in this podcast that we should talk about?
Oh, do we want to talk about constitutional revision a little bit?
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Okay. Yeah. So essentially, constitutional revision was a is something that Abe himself is very passionate about, and he wanted to see happen during his time as prime minister. Here, I think in the Western media, we tend to get caught up by Article 9 and revising Article 9, but realistically, that's not what the focus would be on. There's a lot of other things. Again, this is a constitution that a lot of Japanese, I think, rightly believe was imposed on them by a foreigner. So they do want to, in a way, take more ownership over it. And there's some like interesting issues that they want to talk about, like environmental rights, fiscal discipline provisions, subsidies for private schools, limiting the influence of upper house, same-sex marriage. There's just some like a lot of like issues that could be dealt with that don't even touch on Article 9. And I think just because of the how much emotion Article 9 evoked, that's probably still going to take like decades. But what Abe's goal might be would be to change the Constitution just to prove that, you know, it can be done, which is why I think he's going to be very careful about it and careful about what issues he chooses. He'll probably try to choose issues that it's easy to build a national consensus on. And so the first step would be, because again, when he came into power, the first part he wanted to change was Article 96, which was about the process of how to change the Constitution. So I think his priority, you know, if he'll again he'll do well this election, if they get around a constitutional revision, it's not going to be Article 9. It's not going to be the contentious security issues. It's going to be something a little bit more, again, easy to build a consensus around. And the point would be to prove that this foreign document can be changed by Japanese. And then again, it'll probably be like a decade or maybe even more before they actually get around to Article 9. And they reinterpreted it to allow collective self-defense. So that's probably as far as their Japanese society is ready to go at this time.
Right, and the Japanese military is quite formidable, regardless of
Right.
the perceived limits on its ability to militarize. And that's actually, you know, what you just said is absolutely right. I've written on Japan's constitutional reform processes in the past, and I think a lot of the Article 9 mania that you read about in the Western press is definitely, you know, a point well taken. Well, Mina, thanks a lot for joining me on this episode of the podcast today.
Yeah, thank you. So much fun.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you, and hopefully we'll have you back later this year to talk a bit more. Maybe we'll do a podcast devoted entirely to Japanese security, and we can even talk about Japan's broader regional role, its relationship with Southeast Asian countries, its increasing interest in the South China Sea disputes. There's a lot to talk about. I don't think Japan will be going anywhere. And actually, I myself will be traveling to Tokyo in November, so maybe when I come back, we can talk a bit about the country then as well. Well, thanks for joining me.
Be great.
Thank you. And for our listeners, do remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and leave us a review. If you have suggestions for future topics that you'd like to hear on the podcast, definitely do either shoot me an email at ankit@thediplomat.com, or you can always tweet at me on Twitter, where I'm at NKTPND. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back soon with more.